This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
In a distant corner of our galaxy, a secret observatory is attacked. A brilliant scientist is found. And a mysterious ribbon of energy where past and future collide is unleashed.
It's a doorway that we call the Nexus.
Every ship which has approached the ribbon has either been destroyed or severely damaged.
Obviously, they were looking for something.
There's still no indication of why they attacked the station.
I must return to the observatory immediately.
There's nothing I can do.
Timing is very important in my experiment. I have an appointment with Eternity, and I don't want to be late.
Someone doesn't care about weapons or power. He just cares about getting back to the Nexus.
The star is going to collapse in a matter of minutes.
That'll destroy everything in this system.
Population?
230 million, sir.
Why would he destroy a star?
I have to stop him. But I can't do this alone. I need help.
I know someone who can.
You say history considers me dead.
Who am I to argue with history?
You're a Starfleet officer. You have a duty.
I don't need to be lectured by you. I was out saving the galaxy when your grandfather was in diapers.
Now, the torch of adventure is about to be passed.
Eliminate them.
Klingon vessel decloaking directly ahead, sir.
Target their bridge!
Fool disruptors!
Let's go!
Bridge, we have a new problem!
All right, let's move them out. Let's go. Take them out.
10 seconds to warp core breach.
All hands, brace for impact!
Let's try and cheat death together.
Warp one, engage!
Star Trek Generations.
Wait, you mean they're together? Ooh, mystery. Aren't they like something 100 years apart? Maybe not that far. Less than 100 anyway. Welcome back, everyone, to this episode of Pop Goes the Classics here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed. We are at Chapter 7 of our 10-chapter series on the great Star Trek motion picture franchise legacy. We have reached a turning point for the franchise as the baton is passed from one captain to the next. You heard the trailer. This week, Star Trek Generations. How did they pull this off? We'll see. I am, of course, your co-pilot, Scott Criscolo. Joining me, as always, Tech. How are you? What's going on?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me back.
Always. Always. Half your show, sir. I put you on as science officer. All right. Speaking of science officers, he's not in this one.
He is not.
No. Before we dive in, let's update everyone on our scores of our statistics. Just to recap for those who, if you're listening to this one and didn't listen to the first six, stop and go back to part one and listen to the first six, because we did the first six, the original series cast. They are now all retired, sans the boss, who we think is retired, or thought he was anyway. So, of course, as you know, Tech and I have been scoring the first six films. And with five categories: plot, cast, villain, production value, aka sets, effects, etc., and music. Here is your scores, sir. At the top, you have Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, at 44. Star Trek, wait, no, scratch that. I can't read my writing. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, at 48. Then Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, at 44. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, at 42. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, at 39. Star Trek The Motion Picture, at 36. And Star Trek V, The Big Pile of Poop, at 25. The final drop. The final flush. Thank God it wasn't the final flush. My scores, I have a lot of halvesies. I have The Wrath of Khan at 49.5. I have Search for Spock at 43, Undiscovered Country at 40.5, Voyage Home 37.5, Motion Picture 34.5, and The Final Frontier 24.5. So I think the only difference is, do I have, okay, I have Search for Spock at 2, and you have Undiscovered Country at 2. Otherwise, yes, we're the same on everything else. Okay. Not bad. Did you think that you would, as you've been doing your research, because you've seen these movies a zillion times, so your grades are immensely valued, did you feel this was your order for the first six to this point?
It's a funny thing to think about, because I know which of these movies I love, and
right,
for what reasons I love them.
Yep.
But since we are using this approach, this five category grading system, things are coming out, not to say skewed, but differently.
Correct.
Than what my heart would say. Like I know what my top three are, mm-hmm, and you would not know that by looking at these scores.
Correct.
I absolutely love Star Trek IV, but when grading it on a, you know, on the levels we have been, yeah, I'm gonna look at it objectively and say, yeah, this isn't perfect, or the, you know, this is a little subpar, and yeah, that's gonna make it, you know, give it a low score and put it low in the rank. But it doesn't change the fact that I love the movie for what it is. So it's funny to kind of look at it from this perspective and treat them as such.
Right, and I mean, we know that we still have three left after this, after tonight's show. So the grades can still be, you know, moved around. And I know for a fact what you're going to think of our next episode. So as will I, we'll see. So now let's give everyone an update on where we are in the franchise. So when we last, our last chapter, last week's show, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, was the final episode for the original series cast on camera, on the big screen, at least we thought, well, most of them anyway. We would see most of the original cast in and out of the Next Generation series, whether before or after that movie.
Correct.
Depending where, what episode they were on, what season they were on, because as we had said last week on the show, Star Trek VI came out in 1991, and Next Gen was on season, what do we say, five, four, something like that, four or five. And so, but members of the original series cast, TOS, have been on episodes of the series either before Star Trek VI came out or after, mostly before.
Well, DeForest Kelly was in the pilot.
Yep.
Which, you know, well before. Yep. James Doohan shows up in season six, which is
okay, so after this. Yep.
And Leonard shows up in Unification, which is,
I think, after.
Oh, crap. Which season is that? Season five. That is season five.
So right around that time.
Yeah. Oh, that's correct, because if you watch Unification came out right before Star Trek VI,
okay,
because, it aired on November 4th of 91, and there is a line that Spock says to Picard regarding the events of Star Trek VI, which audiences had not yet seen, so it was done intentionally to kind of seed that, you know, or plant that seed in the audience, and be like, oh, what's he talking about, and then you get to see it, you
right,
know, weeks later.
Right.
Yeah. So three of the TOS cast showed up on Next Gen over the course of its run.
Right. The rest of them pretty much retired. Like Nichelle, we won't see again. Walter, I don't think we see again.
George, we will see again on Star Trek Voyager.
On Voyager, we'll see him, yep, on Voyager. That show has not started yet to our point, to this point. In fact, it'll start the following year.
Yeah.
As for the boss, we'll get to him in a minute. So the date, November 18th, 1994. So it's been about 3 years since Star Trek VI. At this point, Next Gen, as we keep talking about, is done. They concluded in the spring of 93.
No, that was the same year, wasn't it?
Was it 94?
94?
93, 94? Let's confirm that. Because I thought it was spring of 93, but I...
Yeah, it ended on May 23rd, 1994.
Okay, so the show had been off the air, had been only off for a few months. Okay. So Next Gen was concluded on the small screen, so we all knew it was time for them to graduate to the bigger screen. Star Trek Deep Space Nine had just concluded. I think they were in the middle of season two. Because they started 93, 94. So they were just starting season two. And Star Trek Voyager, which you just mentioned, sir, would start the following fall of 95.
January 95.
January. Yep. Of 95. When the UPN, the United Paramount Network, launched. Mm-hmm. Gee, a Paramount-led network launched with a Star Trek show. I bet you they never thought of that, did they?
That was the plan back in the 70s.
Go back to chapter one of our series and you'll know what we're talking about. All right. So with Next Gen off the small screen, it was time for them to graduate. Now, I don't remember I was in college at this point, so I don't totally remember the machinations leading up to, like, the trailer and what the story was. What do you remember about the build for this movie? Because I don't totally remember the whole thing with the captains and all that kind of stuff. What do you remember about kind of the build leading up to this?
Oh, very little. I mean, I knew it was happening. At this point, I'm not a full-fledged Trekkie yet in 1994. I am a casual movie watcher. So I was, you know, aware that this movie was coming. I didn't actually see it until it was on video. I did not see this movie in the theater. So to the point where my Trek knowledge was so little or so minuscule that when they showed the time jump in this movie and it says 78 years later, that didn't process. I was not aware at that point that Kirk and Picard were separated by that amount of time.
Correct. I but yeah, okay.
Yeah. Very little going in. I just knew that it was happening. My investment was not fully solidified at this point.
Okay. I remember being excited because to give everyone a little background of my Trek fandom, I watched all of the original series when it was in syndication in the 80s when I was a kid. I watched all the movies. I am a giant James Tiberius Kirk fan because he had lots of hot alien women on his show, and I just thought he was cool. Then Next Gen started, and I'm like, who the fuck is this old guy? He's not cool. He's bald, skinny. He's not cool. He doesn't have Kirk's hair. Women aren't going to drip off him. You know, that was my thinking. And, 14 years old, raging with hormones. Of course, I'm thinking, this guy's not going to pick any alien chicks up. Now, Frakes, that guy I like. He's suave. And then, of course, I saw Marina and went, Hachi Machi. There weren't any hot women like that. Well, I'd say some. Grace Lee Whitney, when she was younger, was pretty hot. I will say that. I didn't jump on the Next Gen bandwagon at the beginning because I thought it was very weird. My dad loved, God rest his soul, my dad loved Next Gen. He loved the original. So he loved Trek in general. But he liked Next Gen. He watched it. It was always on Saturdays, if I remember, at like 5 o'clock on... whatever, WB or Channel 9 or whatever, you know our stations up here. But I did not wrap my head around Next Gen because I just thought the cast wasn't cool. You know, like I'm like, these guys are, get this android who talks funny and, oh, wow, the guy that hosts Reading Rainbow. Cool. Well, like that was my thinking.
First season. There was nothing cool about the first season.
There really wasn't. And then I'm thinking to myself, I walk in and my dad's watching it. Now, I was a freshman in high school. So I walk in and my dad's watching an episode during season one. And I go, what's this, Pop? He goes, it's the new Star Trek show. I'm like, why is it carpeted? He goes, I don't know. It's carpeted. I'm like, why is it carpeted? Come on, Dad. Our Enterprise was cold and steely. And you don't hang out on the bridge like it's a lounge. I'm like, why is it? Wait a minute. There's a Klingon? They're bad guys. Because remember, when that show started, they were still bad guys.
Really?
So I'm like, what the fuck is this? So completely transparent, no interest in Next Gen when it first started. None. I'm like, they're dorks. They're not cool. Who's that old guy? Why does he talk funny? I don't know why I talk funny. I knew he had a British accent. I didn't say that. I'm just being funny. But I'm like, he's not Kirk. He doesn't have cool hair and those pointy sideburns, and he's not going to pick up alien women.
And that was a big thing. That was a shared mentality back then. There were a lot of, you know, purists who were like, this isn't my Star Trek, nor will it be my Star Trek. You know, it's not an attitude that continues through multiple fandoms to this day.
Yeah, I know.
You know, is always a great way to be.
I mean, I have since, of course, smartened up, and the show is fucking amazing. I wouldn't have spent the money I did on the Blu-ray, on the series on Blu-ray if I did.
Absolutely. But yeah, like, you watch that first season, and it's a freaking miracle that it became what it was. But, you know, that was due to a regime change and all that, and, you know, writers and everything. So season two still kind of has that look and feel to it, but it really starts to pick up then. And, you know, once I like to clock it by when the uniforms change in season three, that's when it just takes off.
I agree. It definitely needed a little bit of time to iron out. First off, you had, and then, you know, I see, you know, Marina, and I'm like, wow, she is hot. And then, of course, I watch, you know, the doctor, and I go, Jesus, what a bitch. I'm like, she's not Bones. You know, she tries to act like Bones, but nah, very, very misogynist. I was like Bond and GoldenEye. It's like, this is kind of a culture shock, admittedly. But as the show progressed, as you said, they settled in and ended up being seven amazing seasons. And they are beloved, in the end. And of course, talking about Worf in the beginning, the purists are like, Klingon on Starfleet? Fuck that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, Worf is the coolest motherfucker in the bunch. Yeah. So.
And what's cool is, you know, you get to tell that story, I mean, chronologically in the past, but on the screen in the future. When you watch Star Trek VI, yeah.
Correct. Yep. So I said to myself, as Next Gen ended, you said, well, it's time to, you know, obviously it's time for Picard and Riker and all the gang to graduate from small to big, just like Kirk and that gang did. I mean, it took them 10 years. It's only taken them 7 months, but they obviously shot this while they were doing their final season, of course. So here's the plot. We go to 2293. The year 2293, Kirk and Scotty and Chekov, all retired, are on the maiden voyage of the Enterprise B. During the shakedown cruise, which everyone knows is the maiden voyage, the Enterprise is on a rescue mission. They hit this weird ribbon of energy. The refugees are saved. The ships get killed, destroyed. The Enterprise gets trapped by the ribbon. Kirk goes to engineering to help the Enterprise escape. The Enterprise does escape, but the ribbon rips open the hull on the decks where Kirk was. So he is presumed, you know, blasted out into the void. The most decorated Starfleet captain in the history of the world and the universe is dead. Long live the king. We fast forward 78 years to 2371 to the Enterprise D. And our Next Gen crew is celebrating Worf's, I almost said graduation, Worf's promotion to Lieutenant Commander. Picard and the gang find out that, Picard finds out his brother and nephew were killed in a fire on their vineyard, right?
Yep.
Yeah. He's distraught that the Picard family line will end with him. The Enterprise receives a distress call from an observatory where an Elorian, Dr. Tolan Soren. The Elorians, by the way, are the ones that were saved 78 years earlier, including this guy, launches a trilithium probe at a star. The probe causes the star to implode, creating a shockwave that destroys its planetary system. Soren kidnaps Enterprise engineer Jordi Laforge and is transported off the station by a Klingon bird of prey belonging to the dumbfoundedly sexy Dora sisters. I don't know how the heck they got two Klingon women to look kind of smoky, but push up bras. Guinan, of course, played by Whoopi, tells Picard that she and Soren were among the Elorians rescued 78 years ago, and that Soren is obsessed with re-entering the ribbon to reach the Nexus, an extra-dimensional realm that exists outside of normal space-time. Picard and Data determine that Sorin, unable to fly his ship directly into the ribbon, altering the path of the ribbon, removing the gravitational effects. He plans to destroy another star to bring the ribbon to him, to Viridian 3, killing millions on a nearly inhabited planet in the process. Eventually, we get Picard fails to stop Sorin from launching another probe, and both men enter the Nexus. Picard finds himself surrounded by a family, but realizes it's an illusion. He is confronted by an echo of Guinan, and after being told that they may go wherever and whenever he wishes within the Nexus, Guinan says only one man can help you fix this. And who does he find? Hidden in the ribbon, my man, James Tiberius Kirk. I won't spoil it if you haven't seen it, but eventually, yada, 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 things are solved. Kirk dies. Sorry, I got to say it. And the Enterprise, which gets destroyed, by the way, the Enterprise D, because that seems to be something that needs to be done in these movies. Yeah. The ship we love needs to get destroyed. And, but the ship will not be the last to carry the name Enterprise, because of course it won't. I got to be honest. I remember when I first saw the movie, I thought the plot was a little confusing.
Oh, me too.
which I think is notorious sometimes for Trek movies. Sometimes you can't wrap your head around shit. Eventually, I got it. I remember when I rented it, I liked it. And then I had the DVD, the single DVD for a while. And then now I own it, of course, with the other special editions. Your thoughts on the plot. Is it too convoluted? Was it? Could they have found, if they really wanted Kirk and Picard to be together, could they have found a plot more linear?
That's the question, because you literally have two characters separated by almost 8 decades, and you have to find a way, a very Star Trek way, you know, a wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey way, as it were, to bring them together. And so far, as we mentioned earlier, the three characters from this era that we'd seen interact with the Next Gen crew, we saw a really old Leonard McCoy at the beginning. So that's one way to do it, that people just live longer in the 24th century. Scotty was brought in due to being in transporter suspended animation for a few decades, and Vulcans are naturally long lived. So there's, you know, three ways to do those. When it came to Kirk, it was really, I really don't think there was any other way to do it. I think what they came up with just kind of solved the problem they had. I'm no writer, so I couldn't think of anything better to do it, or a better way to do it.
Right. Well, it was written by Ronald Moore and Brandon Braga, and produced by Rick Berman, so all of the Next Gen dudes. Directed by David Carson, who before this, his resume leading up to this was mostly television. He did do a couple of movies, actually mostly television. He would be in the – it was his first – actually, it was his first movie. He was mostly TV, including 4 episodes of Next Gen. He would eventually – He also did 4 episodes of L.A. Law, 2 episodes of Alien Nation, 2 episodes of The Return of Sherlock Holmes, and The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. He, 4 episodes of Doogie Howser, M.D. Oh, shit, he directed 2 episodes of Beverly Hills 90210. He's crossing all these. And at that time, he had done 4 episodes of the first couple of seasons of Deep Space Nine. So he definitely had cred in the Trek world.
Yeah, the entire crew of this movie, production crew, is carryovers from the series. The director, yeah, he cut his teeth on 4 episodes, so he knew this cast, he knew this show. You know, Brandon and Ron are, you know, writers who did a good chunk of episodes in the series. You know, Herman Zimmerman is back, who had done the previous couple of movies, but had also done the series. So yeah, it's the movie is a very clear extension of the series. It's not like they brought in a whole new crew and like, oh, just get a director who's unfamiliar with Star Trek. We'll get to that later to do this movie and, you know, have it go completely off the rails. No, it's very much in line with everything that had been seen. Well, we'll talk about production in a bit. But yeah, it was a good through line in terms of the look and the feel and all that.
Okay. Where would you grade it?
Sorry, I jumped categories. Are we still?
You're learning
plot?
Here in the Place to Be Network. Are we still? You're learning how to on put production? On tangents. I approve. You're hired. Tangents like that.
Yeah. Are we on plot? Or are we on production?
Yes, we're on plot. Production's
we're on plot.
Later.
Okay.
We're on plot.
The first thing I want to say about the plot is yes. I remember watching this. I agree with you. When I first saw this, as a, you know, 11 or almost 12 year old, I think, being more or less lost. Like I said earlier, I didn't understand the time jump. I didn't understand the generational gap, even though it's right there in the freaking title. I didn't really know the next gen characters. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize that the ship was, you know, blown up at the end of the movie. I was like, wait, didn't we just, you know, start this adventure, whatever? So I had very little to go on. As time went on and I watched this movie, I definitely started to get it, gained a love for it. And to repeat myself a little, it's definitely in line with what Star Trek The Next Generation had established itself to be. It's very much a story written by the guys who did this show. It very much feels like an episode, sure, just on a grander scale.
Right.
It also, if you want to get everything out of it, it requires the viewer to have seen, I mean, at least some of the Next Gen episodes. Specifically, I think there are about six. Yeah, there are six episodes that you really need to see to fully understand this movie. And it's Family, which is season two, season four, episode two, which is where you meet Picard's brother, nephew, and sister-in-law. So knowing that story gives the viewer the impact of what happens to him. Brothers, which is the episode after that, season four, episode three, where we Data is meets his father and is given his emotion chip, and then later descent parts one and two, season six, episode 26, season seven, episode one, where we see Data experience his emotion chip but choose not to use it. And in this movie we see him go to it, which he is the chip which he has kept all this time. So again, knowing that, or else you're just like, what is this thing he has that he's talking about, right? And then if you want to know who the Dura sisters are, you got to watch Redemption parts one and two, season four, and finale, season five opener. So yeah, it requires quite a bit from the viewer to get that full experience. But That's just from, you know, the in-universe perspective. When it comes to all the new stuff, you know, again, a very next-gen plot. You have a singular antagonist who may or may not be sleazy when you first meet him, and then you realize, oh, this guy's up to something, and, you know, Of course, now the stakes are, you know, on a planetary scale, obviously, because you can, because it's a movie now.
Right. Yep.
It's not just a interplanetary scale, I should say. You know, he's literally blowing up worlds to serve his own ends. So yeah, it's very much in line with what we know, what we've seen as viewers of Next Gen. I will say this: I don't understand how John Harriman made captain to be given the Enterprise B. with all respect to Alan Ruck and his performance, like, this guy looks like he's fresh out of the academy and he's acting as such. See, crap, now I'm skipping out. I'm talking cast balls. All right.
This is tremendous.
Put a pin in that. All right. Yeah. Plot. Yeah. The Nexus. Yeah. All in all, it's solid. Like I said, I'm just going to repeat myself again. Keeps a nice continuity with the tone and the feel of this show that this is a movie of. It does seem a little weird though that the show ended only months before with a finale. Like, you know, the show ends on this grand story, you know, all good things, you know, we're dealing with literally the past, the present, the future. And then there's, you know, this big resolution. And then at the end, you have the crew together and, you know, you have that beautiful pullout from them at the poker table and everything. And then here we are 5 months later. It's just like, oh, everything's still going. Oh, right. Because they're still out there.
Right.
Their mission didn't end just because the series didn't. But yeah, so plot, stakes are pretty cool with the whole blowing up the planets and everything. We've got, you know, essentially a mad scientist on, you know, on the run here, and, you know, they did a decent job, although it really makes you scratch your brain tissue a little to wrap your head around what's going on in terms of space and time and, you know, the Nexus and what is reality and all that. So, I give the plot a 7.
Okay, that's actually what I was going to give it. I was going to give it a 7 as well. It was once I figured it out, it's as solid as it can be, but it definitely took a little time to process. And I understand how Alan Ruck could have really gained the respect of the Enterprise crew wearing a Red Wings jersey. Duh. And call him Captain
Dad's Starship. Oh, no,
exactly. Sense. Exactly. Captain Cameron. Anyway, so I gave it a 7 as well. All right. Now we'll talk cast. And we just mentioned Cameron. All right. So Alan Ruck is in it, of course. But the cast we have to chat a little bit about because for the first time we are seeing the next gen cast on the big screen. So we have, of course, Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, LeVar Burton, Michael Dorn, Gates McFadden, Marina Sirtis, the next gen crew. Let's talk about them for a minute, just them. Compare and contrast. Listen to me, I sound like I'm in a film class. Compare and contrast their debut here compared to TOS's debut in the motion picture.
Like I said, this, nothing is really given a grand, statement in terms mm-hmm. of here we are, you know, right. They just treat this movie like it's an extension of the series, which it is. I'm not sure. Faulting them for that. There's no hell. The first shot of the Enterprise is just from like essentially over the shoulder as it approaches a space station. You don't get like a glory shot of it. Like, oh, here's the Enterprise in space on the big screen. No, they just treat it like that. I mean, you get to see everybody together initially on the holodeck for the promotion ceremony. And yes, they're on a, you know, 18th century sailing ship version of the Enterprise. You know, they're all dressed up like old-timey naval officers, but it's cool to see them all together. It's especially funny because there they are in these hats and uniforms, and there's Geordi with his visor, there's Data with his white skin, so it's just, it's got that, it just, it reminds you, right, we're still in Star Trek. This isn't some weird alternate reality. So yeah, nobody really gets a, like, an entrance or, you know, an applause break or anything. Like, somebody doesn't walk in, you know, and just kind of stop and look in multiple directions and then keep walking. They treat it like it's, you know, next week on Star Trek The Next Generation. You know, it just looks a lot prettier.
Correct.
But you asked in a contrast, or, you know, comparing it to TOS. Like,
do you think, I'll simplify the question. Do you think that they felt more comfortable and settled in quicker, or it took them longer than the original cast settled in the motion picture? Now, in the next gen cast's defense, they're still on, you know, they're still kind of in the groove because the series only ended 7 months before, and they were shooting the movie while they were finishing the last season. Yeah. Whereas the porn TOS cast hadn't been together in 10 years. I mean, I guess you could count the animated series, but who knows if they voiced that together? I mean, I'm sure they did. So
yeah, that is exactly the main point. You have this crew, literally, you know, cast and characters just coming to work the next week, you know, virtually no time has gone by. No one has missed a step. Whereas, in the motion picture, it's been 10 years. And, you know, you get those you get some of those moments. You get, you know, the shot of Shatner in the window of the shuttle and, you know, the music swells and everything. And he walks into frame and all that. Spock gets his grand return. You know, the ship docks and he walks into the airlock and everybody stops when he comes on the bridge. And, you know, McCoy beams aboard and has his back and forth with Kirk. And, you know, and then in Trek fashion, just, you know, Scotty, Uhura, Sulu and Chekhov are just kind of there.
Yes.
So, but yeah, it's a major contrast, yeah, because of the time difference and the with this movie with Generations, the move to the big screen was essentially expected. Whereas in 19, you know, it with motion picture, it's like, oh, this is huge, you know, we're getting a movie, you know, everything's gonna look better and brighter and all this. So yeah, definitely a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like my cast grade. I think they were amazing. What do you give the cast? Oh, well, let's continue the cast. So that's the main cast, of course. Yeah. We have to keep adding. We have more to talk about. So then we have the three members of TOS, of course. I mean, Scotty and Chekhov aren't on very long. Technically, neither is the Shat. He's not really on that much either. He's in, what, the last 35 minutes probably of the movie?
Not even.
He's in the first 15 and the last, probably like what, first 15, last 15, something like that. Maybe last 20.
Yeah, something like that. 10-20 maybe, I think, is the split.
Something like that, yeah. And Whoopi. We can't forget Whoopi as Guinan. I don't want to forget Whoopi. And then our villain, another one of yours and my favorites of all time. Alex himself, Malcolm McDowell. Man, they know how to pick the good bad guys, huh? They really do. On a side note, well, we'll get to Malcolm McDowell in a minute because I got an interesting fun fact you may not know. So the cast overall, Cameron included, and the woman that plays Sulu's daughter.
Yes.
Yeah, daughter, which is kind of cool. Overall, it was neat, and we can talk about the fact that Kirk and Picard. It was obvious the franchise, like the Muckety Mucks. I mean, obviously, you know, the Harv Bennett's are gone, and I don't know how much Nick Meyer's around much in these 90s movies, but if I remember correctly, I'm not sure.
Not at all.
So the TOS crew is gone in terms of behind the scenes. So we are literally starting from scratch, and I think that's what it should be. Overall, I thought the cast was great. I thought the next gen crew definitely settled in like a comfy pair of slippers. Good villain. The Dura sisters. I'm giving the cast an 8.5.
I'm almost right there with you. Yeah, I was bouncing between 8 and 9. So I think I'm gonna have to go with you on that 8.5. Okay. I think that's my first half a point rating.
I think it is. You had a couple of 9.5s
earlier.
Undiscovered Country. Oh, okay. 9.5. You actually gave the cast a 9.5 in 6 and the production. Ah. But it added up. You don't have any halves in your totals. I have halves all over.
Yeah, no, the cast is great because, again, the entire next gen cast doesn't miss a beat. You know, they're literally just coming to work. You know, they know their characters, they know their jobs. The only one who really gets to branch out is Brent. Brent Spiner is Data because here he is, you know, fully emoting, you know,
right.
It's funny how he starts the movie almost emoting where he's dour and confused. He's like, I think, you know, I don't know if I can evolve without, you know, dipping my toe into this proverbial pond. And then, you know, he starts experiencing things for the first time. You know, the scene in 10 Forward is funny with he looks like he hates it more, please, you know. And then where he's just laughing uncontrollably and it's pissing Geordi off. And then he realizes that something is horribly wrong. And then that's where it really takes a really good turn for him, because there's that whole stellar cartography scene where he's just completely preoccupied with guilt. And, you know, and he flat out tells Picard, he's like, I can't do my job, but, you know, take me offline. I can't do this. And Picard just takes him to task. He's like, you are an officer on this ship. You know, we all deal with emotions. You will deal with them too. That's an order, Lieutenant. And it's great because Brent he literally like snaps to it. Like he does that head cock. He's like, yes, sir. And he just kind of brings him back. Great, great performance from Brent throughout. And yeah, I mean, I challenge anyone to say anything bad about Patrick Stewart.
No, you can't.
Yeah, so there's barely anything you have to say about him. The early stuff, like I said, Alan Ruck, you know, the guy's a legend. You know, he's a major that guy. The character is ridiculous. A captain of, you know, an Enterprise, which is already, you know, a distinguished name. And this guy's just, you know,
what do I do? What do I do?
Yeah, you've got Chekov and Scotty, which were supposed to be Spock and McCoy. Let's not beat around the bush. It was written as such. But DeForest Kelly couldn't do it because his health was waning, and Leonard didn't do it because he didn't like how the scene played out, and he felt it was a glorified cameo, and I can't blame him.
Right.
You know, so they just, I feel bad for Jimmy Doohan and Walter, because they were just kind of like, you're our second choices.
I know.
Can you come in and do this? Yeah, sure. So, that's kind of where I lose a bit of that my score is just, yeah, just kind of window dressing at that point. But yeah, then you've got Malcolm McDowell, who I won't go into the villainy of it, but his performance is great. He's a man obsessed, and he plays it well. He's just, I don't care. I don't care about anyone. I don't care who gets in my way. I don't care who dies. This is what I want. This is what I have to do, and I'm going to do it. You know, and his lines are great. He has that wonderful line to Picard, time is the fire in which we burn, which, of course, in the context of the movie, you know, just completely shakes Picard. But Malcolm McDowell loved that line so much that he had it engraved on the pocket watch prop that he uses in the movie and kept it.
That's great.
which is awesome. Like, that's killer prop right there.
Yes.
And then the last thing I'll say is about Shatner. You know, for a guy who is famously up his own ass,
pretty much,
but we love him. He goes along with the idea that his character, this character that he's known for, you know, bites the big one heroically. So I think that's what, you know, helped him along, was that he knew that Kirk would go down fighting, making a difference, as the line goes in the movie. But funny enough, one of my favorite Kirk moments in this entire movie is in the opening. It's when they're on that shakedown cruise and, you know, Captain Harriman is like, we can't do anything. We're ill-equipped. And they get this distress call. And he says, it like, you know, call somebody else. We can't do it. And it cuts to Shatner, and he's in his chair, and he just almost jumps out of his chair with this look. It's just a look on his face that, yep, essentially says, are you shitting me, man? You have to do this. It's not a word comes out of Shatner's mouth, and you can tell exactly what he's thinking.
Yep.
It's a wonderful moment of acting, and I give him mad props for it.
Yep.
So yeah, that's right up there with my Star Trek III Captain Kirk moment.
Yes. The warp. Yeah. Yep.
So that's my piece on the cast.
Yeah, it's amazing, and the Shat was you know, almost defending the brand, if you will. No Enterprise ship has ever, it wasn't Enterprise, but, no Enterprise was ever going to bow out of a, not a fight, but never left anybody hanging. No one left behind.
Their duty, you know, shirk their duty as Starfleet officers. Yeah,
absolutely. Was it a good way for the Shat to go? A lot of people don't like the death.
I was never a fan of it.
It is kind of cheesy.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than the way there were two endings to this movie. The first one, Kirk gets shot in the back by Soren, and just kind of like drops to his knees and, you know, dies slowly and in a very cliched, overly dramatic way. This one, you know, they upped the action where he's, you know, hanging from the collapsing bridge, and then, you know, it collapses and falls, and he dies in the impact. Well, still doesn't die instantly, but still kills him. It never really sat well with me that they bring him into this era only to kill him off. But if you're a Star Trek fan who doesn't like that, you're in luck, because there's a series of non-canonical novels that tell the story of how he was resurrected by a Romulan Borg plot. Something very, very bizarre.
Romulan Borg plot, like the opening to Lower Decks?
Exactly. Cheese it.
Speaking of villains, let's talk about Soren. Mm-hmm. our good friend Malcolm McDowell, who, by the way, do you know who his nephew is?
Malcolm McDowell's nephew. Yes. I know this. I keep wanting to say Ewan McGregor, but that's Wedge Antilles' nephew. That is Lawson. Wrong verse. I do know this, and it's completely left my brain. Who is it? Give me a hint.
Well, he's in the franchise.
Yeah. Oh shoot. Yeah, he's somebody's uncle. Alexander Siddig.
He is Dr. Bashir's uncle.
That's right. Yes.
Yep. Dr. Bashir's Alexander Siddig's mom is Malcolm McDowell's sister.
That's right. Because if you watch Deep Space Nine and you go to the episode Distant Voices, which is a Bashir episode, it's the episode where he's rapidly aging. When he's like super old, his old age makeup makes him look like Malcolm McDowell, and they will never, I don't think they've ever confirmed if that was intentional or not, knowing his family.
That's hilarious though. Question I wanted to ask before we continue on with him, in the redemption is which is the two-parter with Spock?
Unification.
Do they refer to this movie?
No.
Okay. Well, I know what happens before, I guess.
Because Unification came out 3 years, or was produced three
years
ago.
Yeah, that's true. So they didn't even think about it. Okay. I don't know what made me ask that. Never mind.
Well, what's funny is, if you want to talk about that kind of stuff, Scotty is present for the quote-unquote death of Jim Kirk. Mm-hmm. And then when we see Scotty on Next Gen, which was 2 years prior in terms of production, he has no knowledge that the captain has died. So there's a little bit of writing yourself into a corner or not as
progress
to the franchise.
Exactly. Malcolm McDowell goes on the long list of tremendous actors that have always played tremendous villains, like Ricardo Montalban, Christopher Lloyd, Christopher Plummer. Even what's his name who played
Lawrence Luckenbill? Lawrence Luckenbill.
I don't know why I'm brain farted. Even he was a pretty good villain, even though the rest of the movie was what it was. I do like the fact, and this is so, you know, I can't think of a lot of actors that would do this, but this is so Malcolm McDowell. He told them he would take the part on the condition he would not be an alien, or he would not be an alien that required makeup because he was not getting up earlier than everybody else. That sounds like such a Malcolm McDowell thing.
All right, what's the most human-looking alien? All right, what's Guinan? She's an Elorian.
make him do that then. Why? He doesn't want to get up at 4. He'll be happy getting up at 7.
The most makeup he has on in that movie is the big, like, bloody scar in the when you first see him.
Right, yeah, exactly. And that took probably an hour, tops. he is crazed in this. And he definitely brings a cred to this. I don't know if he's one of those that like doesn't like talking about it. It'd be stupid not to. I don't know if you've ever met him at a con. I haven't.
No, I've never seen him at one.
Yeah, I don't think I have. I haven't either. He's one of those guys, though. I mean, I love him. He's another guy who's not done well. The only thing I didn't like him in, and I blame Rob Zombie for that, was his portrayal of Loomis Rob Zombie's second Halloween. He was fucking terrible in that because he was an asshole, and Dr. Loomis is not an asshole if everybody knows Halloween. So didn't like that, but I can't blame him for that. That was kind of Rob Zombie's planning. But anyway, I digress. Your thoughts on Malcolm's performance in his villainous ways? We know he's a great actor. We know his performance was great, but what is his grade of villainy?
Yeah. Sadly dipped into this earlier, so I'm going to repeat myself a little. It's a solid performance. You know, he commits to it. You know, he's just short of over the top villain, I think. I remember again watching this early on. I'm like, oh, you know, crazed mad scientist. You know, but as time went on, I'm like, oh no, he's really like selling this. Again, he's a man obsessed. Does not give a shit about anybody. Like he's literally blowing up worlds. Just so he can get back to his quiet little corner of the Nexus and live out his days in his own personal paradise. Right. But yeah, he when we meet him, you know, on the Enterprise, you know, he's charismatic, and you know, he tries his damnedest to continue his work without rousing suspicion. You know, he has that really cool scene with Picard and Ten Forward, with Patrick Stewart. It starts, you know, he's like, oh, I'd like to finish my work. You know, it's years of research will be lost, you know. And then when Picard kind of says no, that's when he kind of turns it up, and he says the line about time is the fire in which we burn. And then, you know, jump ahead, and the scene again, the two of them, there's all that stuff on Viridian 3. Where yes. It's just the two of them. It's like a two-man play. It's fantastic. It's just the two of them interacting. Dialogue's great. He's doing all this cool stuff. You know, they always joke that DeForest Kelly was bad with props, you know, with his performance. Here's a guy who is literally moving through this set, multiple levels of, you know, ironwork and platforms and ladders, and he's delivering this soliloquy to Patrick Stewart about you know, his life and, you know, time and death and all this. It's, and he's not missing a beat. It's fantastic. And it culminates in that really cool line about time. It's like a predator. It's stalking you. It's just, as only Malcolm McDowell could say it.
I know.
Yeah, no, he is fantastic in this movie. And to the point where the last shot of him is on his little probe launcher when he realizes that it's not going to launch, it's going to explode. And the last shot of him is a close-up of his face, and it's just this look of sadness and, you know, I failed and all this work for nothing. And then he's just gone like that. And it's, again, it's another cool moment of just performance without dialogue. I kind of want to give him a 10.
So do I, actually.
Because he's on point from start to finish in this. Yeah, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to give him a 10. He nails this movie.
Served his purpose. And perfectly.
Yeah. And even when Kirk shows up, it's that, you know, dramatic shot of Kirk standing in front of him, and Kirk looks all heroic. He just looks at him and goes, "And just who the hell are you?"
Yeah. So good. So good. Yeah. Which is funny, because you should know. All right. Production value, sets, effects, shooting, that kind of thing. We see two Enterprises. Of course, the B, which was slightly cushier, but not as cushy. And then the D, which, of course, is the otherwise known as the USS Sheraton. plush, if you will.
Yeah. Beige carpeting and wood rails.
And wood rails. How sexy. It's like a bar on the Explorer of the Seas. Effects were great. We're now into the 90s, so things look a little better than we've had in the 80s. To the 80s credit, they did the best they could, but obviously things are getting a little better as we get into the 90s. The scenes in the climax on the planet with all three of them, the thing in the beginning with the where they're on the D and they're doing the whole pirate, you know, nautical scene for Worf on this Enterprise D. I thought that the shooting was good. I thought that the flow of the movie was solid, relatively colorful. Did feel like a TV episode, though. But in their defense, it's TV people that are doing it. So it didn't feel... We're going to have this discussion two episodes from now about a movie that feels like an episode. This one did, too, though not as level as the other one did. But I thought they did a good job. I thought the action scenes were good. The Enterprise blowing up and the dish crashing and like ripping all the ground up and everything else. That was a cool visual. Not bad. I was impressed. I think they enjoyed the fact they had a $35 million budget for the movie, in which Berman and those guys are usually used to like $5 for an episode. Yeah. So they had a little more play money. But overall, production wise, I thought everything was pretty solid. I thought, again, the effects were good. That crash with the dish was good. The climax with Kirk and Soren and Picard in the end was good. I thought everything was pretty solid from a shooting perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go off your point about the budget, you know, this almost this entire movie uses standing sets. So very little of your budget had to go into that. I think the only new effects work was the observatory model. And and I think that's set because, you know, all the Enterprise sets are pre-standing from the series. The Klingon Bird of Prey bridge, that's the one that they literally been using since 1986 for Voyage Home.
Correct.
The newest set in the movie is Stellar Cartography, which is this fantastic scene. Again, it's the scene with Picard and Data. And Herman Zimmerman himself, the production designer, he said that that set was a dream of his because it's a multi-level room. You know, it's literally two decks just because you've got these massive screens to, you know, project, you know, star cartography, maps of the stars and everything. You know, for some scenes, it's a blue screen to watch it animate. Other scenes, it's just giant printed maps of star charts and everything. Really cool scene. You know, it's got this Cerebro look to it because there's that like central platform that they stand on and everything is around them. So in terms of sets, yeah, that one really kind of, they got their money's worth on that one because they could. The model work is great. Like you said, the dish crash at the end, there's a whole feature about that on the DVD about the model of the dish itself and a separate model, like a, I don't know, like 30 times blow up scale of the front of the dish for those close up shots as they plow through those trees. And then, you know, a lot of cool compositing with as it comes through the atmosphere and all that. You know, there's a little bit of reuse with the Bird of Prey. It's literally the exact same explosion as the end of Star Trek, of the previous movie.
Right.
They got their money's worth. Like I said before, you literally just carried your crew over, your writers, Rick Berman, your producer, Bob Blackman, your costume guy, Michael Westmore, your makeup guy, and Herman Zimmerman, your production designer, and, you know, again, David Carson directing. One fun thing to note is the mix of the uniforms in this movie to kind of show that transition, because you have the next-gen uniforms, I say that with quotations, the big color over the chest with the collar and everything. And you see here the uniforms from DS9 and later Voyager, where it's the one-piece jumpsuit with the color on the shoulders and that kind of like purple turtleneck underneath, which is funny because apparently instead of making new uniforms, because only a couple of the characters use them in this, I think Patrick Stewart is the only one who had his new uniform made for him, which is why Frakes is, when he's wearing that uniform, his sleeves are rolled up because he is wearing Avery Brooks's uniform from DS9.
That's hilarious.
And I think the sleeves were too short, so he just rolled them up. LeVar Burton is wearing Cole Meany's uniform from DS9, and that looks a little baggy on him. So there's that, the uniform transition. But the one thing, that always weirded me out about this movie is the lighting. Every set shown on the Enterprise D, familiar sets we have seen literally for 7 years, are all lit differently. Picard's ready room is dark for the first time. Mm-hmm. 10 forward, which is usually lit by, you know, like the table lights to give it this nice, you know, kind of lounge feel, is blown out with sunlight.
Yep.
The bridge is dark with much different lighting. You know, it gives it much more of like a almost a submarine feel because of how dark and claustrophobic
it is. That's a good point. That's a good way to put it.
So that's one thing that always threw me. And I guess the one other thing to mention is I don't know why they did this, because we've been talking about, you know, the continuity from the series to the movie and how it just feels like they just came to work the next week. The bridge set is very different. Well, not very different. It's different enough. Suddenly there are steps leading up to the captain's chair where there never were before. There are two stations all of a sudden on either side of the bridge where there was just like beige padding with red alert lights. And suddenly Worf has a stool.
Yeah.
He's been standing at that rail for 7 years.
And I know. Now he's
he's crouched down, like he's sitting there. I'm like, it just looked weird after all that time. So, but all in all, we're on a, you know, we're on a big budget set, or a big budget, you know, for the movie. So, you know, the effects look great. The fight with the bird of prey and the Enterprise at the end looks great. You know, the ribbon itself, the Nexus ribbon itself looks pretty great. So I'm going to give production an 8, mainly because of, like I said, those weird changes to the sets in terms of the lighting and the weird bridge changes. And, one other thing that kind of takes a point off, there's one shot of the Enterprise in this movie. It's a shot from the series, and you can tell it's matted weird. The lighting is weird. And it's a shot that's in almost every episode of the show, where the dish comes overhead and you just kind of see the Enterprise cruising away from camera. It's while Picard is giving a captain's log, and it just, compared to every other shot of the ship of the movie, it just looks flat and weird. It looks like it's from Star Trek V.
Yes.
So, yeah, going to give production an 8.
You know what? I'm going to give it an 8 as well. I like your point about the uniforms. They look like Halloween costumes. finally, the music. Dennis McCarthy doing the music. Mm-hmm. Kind of had that TV sound.
Absolutely.
You know?
That's absolutely a point I'm going to make as well.
Yeah. Very tense TV sounding. That doesn't bother me. Do you think that – let me ask you that. Does the music kind of cap off the general sense that the way to ease the cast – the next gen cast onto a big movie screen is to almost make it feel TV-ish, to make the audience and them feel kind of comfortable?
I think so. It's again, not to belittle the point, but you have just a strong carryover of just about everything and included. Like you said, it does very much sound, well, Dennis McCarthy, you know, scored episodes. He wrote, yep, the theme to Deep Space Nine.
Yep.
So yeah, all the cues in this movie feel like, you know, the action scenes or the commercial breaks in an episode. You know, that same orchestration, that same kind of build and lulls and everything. There are times where it definitely sounds like music from an episode, but he also managed to have fun. And when you hear the actual theme, like the theme he wrote for this movie, which is played very, very subtly during the opening with the champagne bottle, mm-hmm, but you get blasted with it for the first time in the movie when Kirk takes off on his horse, the riding scene. That's the first time you get the big theme, and then of course you get it over the end credits. And it's funny because the next gen theme is nowhere in this movie.
Right.
You would have thought it would be there. You wouldn't get it until the next movie because Jerry's back, the man who wrote the theme.
Right.
But yeah, I don't fault Dennis McCarthy. He's a very talented guy. You know, he's a guy used to writing for television. So he was probably very happy to have, you know, the time to score a movie rather than, you know, a day or two to score an episode. But I think he still kind of fell back on what he was used to in terms of his comfort zone. So, yeah, a lot of the music is very much like an episode. There's a lot of choir use, which I think is another, on the other side of things, it's an example of him being able to stretch out a bit. All the stuff in the Nexus is very ethereal. All that, so he used a lot of voices for that, which works very well. But all in all, I love the theme, but I gotta kind of give him a 5 on this one. It doesn't really feel like a complete film score. It feels like half a film score.
Yeah, I'm gonna go one notch up. I'll give it 5.5. But yeah, I do think that it kind of catered to a TV feel where not as much music was needed as a normal movie would, because I think it was still the TV mentality. So I think sometimes the crossover, the seamless transition was not as seamless because I think still the TV mentality was there. I think you saw that in the shooting a little bit, and I think you definitely saw it in the music. Okay, so you have For plot, 7. Cast, 8.5. Villain, 10. Production value, 8. Music, 5. So that's 7, 15.5, 25.5, 33.5, 38.5, your score out of 50. So that puts it higher than the motion picture, but just short of The Voyage Home.
Okay.
Point and a half short of The Voyage Home. I have 7, 8.5, 10, 8, 5.5. So I have almost the same as you, except an extra half point. So 7.5. So mine is 39. So mine is above The Voyage Home, but just short of The Undiscovered Country by 1.5. But higher than The Motion Picture. Okay, so around the same place. So I give it a 39 out of 50. You give it a 38.5 out of 50. The half point goes to Kirk. your overall thoughts on this one. Now, as a fan, looking back now, as you are much more attuned to things, do you still look back on this one fondly?
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoy watching this movie. It's not, obviously, it's not the first one I reach for when I'm in a Trek movie mood. But I like it. I like there are a lot of fun moments. I like all the stuff with Data. Like I said, there's some really good performances. You know, the scene with him and Picard and Stellar Cartography, all the stuff between Patrick Stewart and Malcolm McDowell. The Nexus is a little odd, obviously. Yep. You know, Picard in his Victorian home with his, you know, 18 children running around or whatever. It's just it feels very un-Picard, especially now, having seen the first season of Star Trek Picard, where he, you know, retires, he goes home, he's living in his villa at his vineyard, which it has a different look, but the feel is similar, where he's in this big empty house and he's not comfortable there. He just wants to get back out. So I look back retroactively. I look back on Generations, looking at that, going, this is not Picard's ideal fantasy. He doesn't want a family. You know, he famously hates children throughout the entire run of the show. I'm like, he doesn't want kids. You know, he liked his nephew and that was about it. So that's, you know, it's a little odd. I will say this. I cannot believe I made it through this entire episode without mentioning my absolute favorite scene in this entire movie,
which is
the scene where Picard and Kirk are together on the horses. You know, Kirk, the music swells, Kirk jumps over the ravine a few times, then he comes to realization, none of this is real, you know, I don't belong here, and he gives his speech to Picard about don't stop, essentially. I could recite the whole thing, but I'll spare you. Just don't, you know, don't let them promote you. Don't let them transfer you. Let, you know, always make a difference. And that's what gets him out of the Nexus to say, you know, he says, help me stop Sora and make a difference again. He wanted Kirk to, you know, have one last shot at being Jim Kirk. And I absolutely love that scene. I love how Shatner delivers it. I love the setting, just the two of them together. I love that speech. I absolutely love it. I had it on my wall in college.
Well, it's because it's tremendous.
Yeah.
And now, officially, the original series run is over. We will not see Kirk again in any Trek capacity. This is it. Don't see him on any shows. No more movies. Well, not the Shat anyway. But this is it. What a run. 3 amazing years in the mini on the series, the 1 animated series, and now 6 and a third movies, we'll say.
Yeah.
What a run. Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Tech, where can everyone find you on social media?
Oh, well, if you are so inclined, you can follow me on Instagram at Technicolor, T3KNIKOLOR, or on Twitter at Hal Dameron, Haldameron.
And you can follow me, of course, on Twitter at PTB Podfather. You could see that I have I've kind of seasoned up my name. I added a little pumpkin, and I think it was a devil or something. We have a lot of great Halloween and spooky theme stuff here. As this airs, we'll be through October. Hope you've enjoyed our Halloween stuff, and we'll get into some Thanksgiving and other fun stuff. Coming up next week, part 8, the first next gen centric feature film. It may be making a big move on Tech's list. Big move. He's Tech. I'm Scott. Stay away from the ribbon. Rest in peace, Jim. Picard. All right, you're a little cool.